A podcast that shines a light on the positive, healthy, hopeful projects going on in Humboldt County. We'll talk about things that are happening to help everyone live a better life and what things you can do in your corner of the world. Look, we know about the problems. We talk about them, read about them in the news, and see it every day too. That's what drives us to want better and to be part of the good. My name is Juliette Ferry, and I will be your host of the Humboldt Healthcast, which is another community project of the Humboldt IPA here in Eureka. Today, we will be talking with stakeholders for the Humboldt RISE project. RISE stands for Resiliency and Inclusion Through Support and Empowerment. It's a community project focused on addressing perinatal substance use disorder in Humboldt County. And first, we'll hear some background on the RISE project from project manager Patty Torres, who works here at the Humboldt IPA and North Coast Health Improvement and Information Network. And then we'll pivot to a conversation between Patty, me, and the RISE project's two clinical champions, Dr. Candy Stockton and Dr. Carrie Griffin.
Hi, Patty.
Hi, Juliette.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And why don't we start out with you telling me about the RISE project and how it came about?
Sure. So the RISE project is formerly known as the Perinatal Substance Use Disorder Project. And of course, that's not it's not the most creative name, which is why we, we're very proud of the new name of the project, which I'll talk about in a second. But the focus is very much on people who are pregnant and or parenting and are at higher risk for substance use disorder. The work came about in around 2016, 2017, through an observation that Humboldt County has high rates of perinatal substance use. And this was backed up through research from, through data from the California Office of Statewide Health Planning and Development. That's a mouthful. The acronym is OSHPED, that showed that pregnant women have 3.7 times higher rate of perinatal substance use in Humboldt County than the state average.
Wow.
Of course, you know, those figures are alarming. And so the North Coast Health Improvement and Information Network, which is an organization dedicated to health information exchange and community health improvement projects, partnered with the County of Humboldt and the California Center for Rural Policy to do a project to understand, you know, what are the services available in the community to support pregnant and parenting women with substance use disorder, and what are the gaps. And so through that process, there was a series of key informant interviews that informed some recommendations as far as what the next step should be to address this issue. And so that was really what laid the foundation for the RISE project. And so the RISE project is funded through the Wellbeing Trust in partnership with St. Joseph Health. And so mainly we have three goals, one of which is screen all women for substance use disorder during the perinatal setting. So that is a best practice to universally screen all women as they enter prenatal care. So this helps identify women who, you know, it doesn't diagnose substance use disorder, but it helps identify if you're at a higher risk for substance use.
Right.
The other goal is to support providers in obtaining their X waiver to prescribe medication-assisted treatment. And so the project kind of took a shift from that because it's important that in the community, there are already a lot of providers for medication-assisted treatment. And so we were advised that the focus should be rather to help those women access existing services in the community. and also to develop norms and clinical guidelines regarding cannabis use during pregnancy. That was another finding from the first phase of the project, is that there's a lot of inconsistent communication about using cannabis during pregnancy and the lactation period. So those were sort of the three main goals, and within those goals was the establishment of a perinatal care navigator, Hannah Lippi, who is a social worker through Care Network at St. Joe's, and she is someone that helps her clients access services. So when a pregnant woman or a woman who has recently delivered screens positive with the four Ps, Hannah is someone who can help them access services that are available to them in the community. In addition to that, we developed at Enshin the North Coast Resource Hub, which is an online tool that has community resources. And we recently contracted with RX Safe Del Norte to expand into Del Norte and Curry County, and is focused on substance use disorder services. So it's a mobile-friendly website that you can access through your phone and quickly sort of narrow down onto services that are applicable for your sort of eligibility criteria.
Does the public have access to that search engine, or is it providers only?
The public does have access. We're still in the build phase, and so there hasn't been a really wide push in the community for the resource hub, but we're certainly planning for that as we continue to optimize some of the search features. So that's right. Upcoming. Yeah. It's so I sort of took a deep dive into describing the project and the goals of the project, and I want to just make sure that I circle back to the name. And so through, you know, a group process, we thought what would be a name that really reflects our values and reflects the work that we set out to do. And so RISE is an acronym for Resilience and Inclusion Through Support and Empowerment. And so it's important, I think, that we take a strengths-based approach in our work. And so, you know, what can we do to help foster resilience and inclusion? And you know, that happens through supporting and empowering clients into, you know, accessing resources and helping them make informed choices during their pregnancy as far as their treatment options.
Such a great insight on the project and where it started and why it's happening. And I always feel that, you know, this podcast, I love that we are shining a light, because that's a significant problem, is that women have a much higher rate of using substances during pregnancy. And then as we find out during the interview, and as you and I know, because we talk about it so much at work, of like when you're starting out your life, these babies that have the substances through their mom, then it's like you're set up, you're starting with a shaky foundation in a way. And so in addition to the potential environments that they're exposed to. And so I always just find it revolutionary that our little area, that Humble IPA and the partners that we have in our little community, are making a dent in the trajectory of people's lives. And it's very inspiring to me and gives me a lot of hope for the future of our community.
Our two clinical champions are Dr. Candy Stockton, who is the medical director at the Humble IPA and a primary care provider at the Priority Care Center. She is also a certified addiction specialist through the American Society of Addiction Medicine. And our other clinical champion is Dr. Carrie Griffin, who is also a provider at United Indian Health Services and with Open Arms practice in Eureka. And she also, she's a family medicine doctor, but has particular expertise in working with pregnant women affected by substance use disorder. And they have been just so, you know, so important to the work of the RISE project in their expertise and in their passion for this work.
Thanks to Patty for the introduction of Dr. Stockton and Dr. Griffin. Now we'll turn to a conversation with Candy, Carrie, Patty, and myself, where we talk more about the RISE project and caring for women with perinatal substance use disorder with a trauma-informed approach. And although we will really get into the specifics of this project, the easiest way for me to summarize what trauma-informed care is that it shifts the focus from what's wrong with you to what happened to you.
So my name is Carrie Griffin, and I am now an osteopathic family medicine physician. I did fellowship training in maternal, child, and reproductive health, which means I now do high-risk obstetrics, including C-sections, take care of newborns, and focus on reproductive health issues for women. And the reason I chose the fellowship that I chose was because it was at the University of New Mexico, and it's a two-year program, and we run the largest perinatal substance use disorder clinic for the state. And in residency, which I did at Maine Dartmouth, we had also started the first prenatal care for opioid-dependent women in rural Maine. And I found that work to be so incredibly rewarding. I've always had sort of a trauma-informed lens and background. Before going to medical school, I was a yoga teacher and a yoga therapist, and had really started experiencing how the body does keep the score, to quote the famous book, and the body really does hold on to all of these memories. And you can watch people and the patterns that their nervous systems and their bodies are in continue to make choices from that place until they're able to complete that cycle of trauma. And what I loved about pregnancy is that it can be, it isn't for everyone, but this incredibly motivating time. You're in this liminal space where you have this, you're stepping into this huge new role, or maybe you're stepping into it for another time, but you're in the process of becoming a mother. And there's a lot of potency to that for people. And what I found is that this is often a time when people are able to look within and look at their lives and start to determine, I want to make some changes. And a large part of making those changes is connecting to, for opioid-dependent people, medication-assisted therapy, so either buprenorphine or methadone. But it's also connecting people to coping skills groups, trauma-informed care groups like Seeking Safety, and other social services they need, really doing a full structural vulnerability, social determinants analysis to find out what else in their life is presently unstable. Is it housing? Is it transportation? Is it financial support of themselves? So that all of those things can be addressed. And what I love is I still love taking care of families. And it's really watching that mother-baby dyad become a new thing. And it's a new, it's not just the baby. It really is a whole new life and connection of life. And the generational aspect of this is incredibly important, both going forward and going backward as we talk about trauma. So part of what drew me to working in Humboldt was when I, through a variety of synchronicity kind of circumstances, ended up interviewing here, I realized that there was a dearth of services for this particular population, that there wasn't anything specific to perinatal substance use, and that Humboldt was a place that was ripe for that kind of integrated care. And luckily, after I landed, a couple months after that, the grant that gave birth to the Humboldt Rise Project came through, and I've been very fortunate to continue to work with this project, promoting how to screen for substance use disorders in pregnancy, as well as to promote the use of a perinatal substance use disorder care navigator. So a social worker named Hannah Lippe, who is specifically able to help coordinate services and perform case management for these women and their families.
There's no more motivated person than a pregnant mom. And I hear that in my role as a wellness coach. It's always just like, yeah, I was able to quit smoking when I was pregnant. Like, of course, because I just did. Yeah. Of course I did. And so that it's just like not mom, baby, individual. It's like this whole new entity. And you're right. Just a very powerful force of things. That's really inspiring story.
And I'm Candy Stockton. I'm also a family medicine physician, and I additionally now have credentials. I'm board certified in addiction medicine as well. So I actually came at this from the exact opposite end of the spectrum. Early in my career, I went into practice family medicine in a rural environment, and I have to say that I'm a few years older than Carrie, and in my training, like, trauma-informed care was not a concept that we knew about. Early, adverse childhood experiences, not a thing anybody ever talked about. And so about 5 years into my very rural practice of medicine, I got involved in some quality improvement work, specifically trying to figure out why we couldn't get people with diabetes to have better control of their diabetes, no matter what it was that we tried. And so we tried something really desperate and novel. We set the patients down and asked them to talk to us about why their care, you know, why they weren't getting better and what we could do to help instead of just trying to tell them what we were going to do. And I had this luxury of working in a small enclosed community with multi-generational families. And so I often knew the parents, the grandparents, the children. I cared for all of them, and knew their stories and spent 10 years working with this population. And so I came to know families very well. And over time, as I would talk to people about why they wouldn't take their insulin shots, or why when we showed up at their house to drop off their medicine, they wouldn't even open the door for us, even if we showed up with a bribe of a bag of their favorite groceries, like what would happen? And as I listened to people tell their stories, I never heard people say like, oh, my parents did drugs or there was alcohol in my household and so now I make bad decisions. But they would talk about these really horrific childhood experiences that with my nice white middle class upbringing, like when I originally first started hearing these stories, I thought people had to be making them up. They were so terrible. And over time, I came to just really recognize that there was this thread of poverty, of discrimination, of substance use, and of abuse that ran through many people's childhoods that affected the way that they made decisions in adulthood. And I didn't have a name for it. I didn't know what it was called. It was just this thing that I saw. And I started to think, if you could get a hold of people in their developmental years, in their childhood, and you could change their childhood, then maybe you could change everything that came after that. And right about that time, within just a couple years, is when I started hearing people talk about adverse childhood experiences and this recognition that the trauma that you experience as a child, the abuse, the neglect, the disruption in family structures, all of these things, that they actually have direct measurable correlations. You're 4 to 8 times more likely to suffer from cancer, from heart disease, from diabetes, from, you know, from any number of physical illnesses if you've experienced this trauma in childhood. And when you go back and you look at what these measured traumas are that correlate with that, they're things like neglect, abuse, obviously, disruption of the family structure, whether it's through death of a parent or divorce or incarceration of a parent, active substance abuse in the household. And as a doctor, I looked at this and I said, what's the link on this? What's the one thing that ties us together? And the things that I could affect related to substance use and abuse, right? And the neglect that sometimes stems out of that in some families when there is active substance use, the disruption in the family structure that can happen, particularly when social services or the justice system get involved and disrupt the family. And so I became convinced that if you could provide support to families as they were developing, that it wasn't the presence of substance use that actually caused these problems. It was the complications and harms of substance use that to a large extent are actually imposed on people by the social system and by the legal system and by us refusing to recognize substance use disorders as a legitimate disease and treating them as a social problem instead. And that if we could change that, we could change everything about the future for our communities. And I was fighting a losing battle trying to help people who were 60 change the way the course of their diabetes was going. But if we could change families, we could change our community's future and we could change the way the healthcare system is going. And so that's how I came into this from a completely into the other spectrum. And I had to learn to get over my fear of being around pregnant women so that I could do this effectively. I had gestational diabetes when I was pregnant with both my children, and actually very difficult to control diabetes, ended up putting me in the hospital a couple times. One time left me at home semi-comatose with my 3-year-old daughter by herself. At that time my husband was out of town, and both she and I were at risk of death because of that experience. And nowhere during my pregnancy did people say, I'm going to report you for having a medical condition, or, you know, I understand that you're trying to take care of your diabetes, but it's not perfect. So we're going to have to actually take your child away from you because that's not safe. Like, so my experience having a serious medical illness during my pregnancy that affected both my safety and my baby's safety and my already born child's safety was very different from what most pregnant women with substance use disorder or substance use diseases receive during their pregnancy. I think it's important to call that out because until we change our attitudes about what it means to have a disease, a substance use disorder, we're going to continue to punish women instead of supporting these brand new developing families that have so much potential and so much beauty inside of them and make it a crime and continue to break up and destabilize families instead of actually doing what happened for me, which is that the medical community stepped in and gave me more support and better treatment and closer checkup. And that is what all pregnant women with diseases should get in this country, a non-judgmental, caring, supportive, problem-focused approach that lets us help them be better parents and better families in the long run.
Because this podcast is focused on bringing out the good in the community, I would love it, Carrie, if you talked a little bit about what work you have been doing since you joined Humboldt County around addressing stigma and how people can work to improve the healthcare system and build relationships and avoid re-traumatization and all that.
Yeah. So I really, really believe that the work of stigma is twofold. And the first part is actually working with implicit bias, right? Learning to ask ourselves, why might we be holding stigma? How might we be viewing this person or treating them differently? And then the second piece is learning how to recognize stigma and implicit biases when they're happening in real time. So taking that internal focus and learning how to turn it out, learning how to do that with some facility because you need to be able to do it in real life when you're in the middle of a shift or seeing patients, etc. And some of the things that we've done that have really been stigma focused have been through Humboldt Rise and a variety of different trainings at both hospitals, both at Mad River Community Hospital and St. Joe's, to their labor and delivery staff. We created a trauma-informed care training specifically for addressing stigma in women with a substance use disorder who present in labor. We've also partnered with organizations like First Five, which has a very robust trauma-informed care curriculum, and they do presentations all over. I'm actually one of their speakers now, so it's really fun to get to sort of spread that information into other sectors of the population. Other work that's happened around stigma has also just been the day-to-day showing up, talking to providers, talking to nurses, and, you know, I now do inpatient buprenorphine consults at St. Joe's, and just having other midwives and the residents come in and sit while you do a consult and you're addressing substance use disorder like you would be addressing somebody's gestational diabetes or the chest pain or the shortness of breath that they come in with, and understanding that we can talk about substance use in the exact same way you take a history, the same way that you would take a history of chest pain, which I think is a great example. When did it start? How long have you been having the chest pain? Has anything made it better? When's the last time you had this happen, right? When's the last time you used heroin? How long have you been using it? Have you ever had a period where you stopped using it? Well, that's fantastic. Tell me about what you did in order to support yourself during that time of recovery. It's learning how to take out the bias, that weird, weighted, contracted feeling that people get when they're working with patients with substance use disorder, which invariably can often be traced back to their own discomfort with a family member or a patient or a friend who overdosed. It's usually not about the patient. It's usually us. And I think all of these efforts, which again, I guess to summarize, have mostly been presentations, focused talks, and then just doing the work of showing up and being as unstigmatizing as possible, recognizing that we're all only human and there's always moments where our biases show up. But I think all of those things have been incredibly beneficial And I can honestly say that I've been in this community just about 2 years now. And when I first started, people would call me about a patient to say, Dr. Griffin, your drug baby is having issues feeding. I don't get those calls anymore.
What do you think it is, in your opinion, of like pregnant women or moms with small babies that is like so, I guess, upsetting to the general public? Like, what is the cause, I guess, of that extreme stigma and like disgust that seemingly people have towards that group in particular?
Well, I think it's an unbelievably potent form of structural misogyny. I think we have created so much focus and expectation on women and the virginal mother archetype and all that is connected with that. You are supposed to be perfect. You are only here to care for your baby and be a perfect vessel for this child. All of that takes away a woman's narrative, takes away her autonomy, takes away her own feelings about her body and her pregnancy and her life. It destroys any other narrative that is true for her other than this idea that she is a carrier of the next generation. And the truth is that we're in a moment in time right now, certainly with the Black Lives Matter movement, where we're all being forced to examine what are the ideas and the conventions and the stereotypes that we've all swallowed, hook, line, and sinker, and how do those show up in our day-to-day lives, in the media we consume, and in the structures that create the fabric of our society. And I think that that very visceral response, which you've totally named perfectly, is because of that. I think there's a lot of hidden expectations that we thrust onto women, especially pregnant women, and then add a chronic medical condition, because that's really what it is. And if people aren't able to view a substance use disorder as a sign of chronic disease, then they don't know how to get out of their own internal mechanisms of blame that they've internalized for themselves and certainly for the other people that they're projecting that judgment onto.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And that's a great description of what is happening. And then the irony, the cruel irony, is like stigmatizing and like looking at these women with that eye, stigmatized eye, and then not offering help. So then it's like, what do you think is going to happen? Do you think they're just going to figure it out with no one around? Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Right. Do you think that you said this so well, do you think that your shame and your blaming and the way that you shut down and contract from that person, recoil from them, people can feel that? And people who have high trauma histories and have histories of substance use disorder, these are often remarkably sensitive people. They know the moment that they're being judged. I've had patients leave the hospital against medical advice less than 24 hours after a C-section because they felt judged by a passing comment. And they ripped their bandage off and left before I could even run over to the hospital to try and convince them to stay. And I think that's a good example of the power of stigma and the consequences.
It strikes me that being educated on a trauma-informed response and a trauma-informed approach is every bit as important as a medical provider being up to date on, you know, all the current best practices regarding, you know, labor and delivery and prenatal care. Like, that is every bit as essential to that patient's health and well-being than the medicine you prescribe and you know, how you treat their labor and everything. It's essential.
In psychotherapy, in medicine, there's a huge body of research that the relationship you have between clinician and patient, that in and of itself has a strong protective factor, has a strong component to make healing happen. And increasingly, if we don't start training people in interpersonal skills, we're really, and it's hard because, you know, a medicine has grown so much. I had a family medicine attending who, she just retired in her early 70s, and she could remember being a resident in the 70s. And the first time she ever admitted a patient who was on more than 8 medicines, she was just like, wow, this person's so complicated. That's crazy. And now, you know, as an inpatient you know, family medicine resident, people are routinely on 20 plus medications, and we don't bat an eye about that. So the body of information we've all had to learn has increased. Training time hasn't increased. And at the meantime, we're seeing higher and higher rates of substance use disorders and mental health diagnoses all across this country. And we're not actually receiving training in how to engage with people in a way that fosters deep connection quickly, that builds trust and rapport, and that really allows for shared medical decision making because you've created a relationship with the patient in front of you. I've spent the last 2 years, and I've got one more year of this training, becoming what's called a somatic experiencing practitioner, which this is a body-based form of counseling. And really what it's designed to do is help your nervous system release cycles of trauma. You learn how to pendulate your attention from feelings of fight and flight in the body to feelings of resiliency and capacity. And I now use this all the time with patients. And actually, a lot of what I've been infusing in these trauma-informed care talks has been information from that body of knowledge. Because it turns out there are really practical ways that we can learn how to engage with people and track their nervous systems and help guide them back to moments of resiliency and moments of capacity in their own beings in real time.
That's fascinating. That's so interesting, that concept. And I remember when a couple years ago, when we were first talking, I was first being introduced to the concept of adverse childhood experiences, the ACEs, and trauma-informed care. And the thinking that just kind of set the stage for me is that this isn't one more thing to do on the plate. It is the plate. We have to start here. There's no, like, if you don't think you have time to deal with this or to learn more about it, then you're just going to keep spinning your wheels and really kind of getting burnt out and feeling frustrated. And so to go down this other road, like, yes, it's another thing to consider, but it's really like the only thing, the foundation.
No, I love that. I love that way of thinking, because really this is the milieu. This is the network that we need to sort of have as our foundation, that we need to operate from here. And when you're coming from here, you're right. Your burnout is less because you're actually probably feeling more effective. And even if you're not seeing the A1C drop, or you're not seeing the pregnant patient show up regularly for their prenatal care and they've missed their Glucola for the 80th time, you have this foundation of relationship. And that's where the reward is, I think, for clinicians and providers of any type, as well as for patients. And without that context, and this is just such a family medicine way to frame this, without that context, I think it's hard to do good medical work.
Patty, if you could speak about the screening that's used, and also why universal screening is what is the gold standard.
The Humboldt County community, through the RISE Project and through the project that came before it was officially called RISE, chose the four Ps as a tool. And that's because it's a tool that is in the public domain, meaning that it's free to use, and it's four simple questions. So the P's are present use, past use, parent use, and partner use. And so the order of those starts with, I believe, parent, and then partner, and then past, and then present. So it allows for the person who is doing the screening to sort of start broad and then narrow in on today for the patient that is being screened. And it's important because universal screening helps remove the bias that is inherent in issues of substance use disorder. So oftentimes, you know, we've heard anecdotally that someone just says, well, I had a hunch that this person was using, so we did a tox screening on them. And, you know, that's just, it's a huge problem because really you can't tell who is using and who isn't. And by applying screening selectively, you're doing more harm because you're making this person feel targeted, judged. And of course, that is contrary to everything that we, you know, just were talking about a moment ago about how this is, you know, our work is around building relationships, building rapport, not re-traumatizing folks that have already had such negative experiences in the healthcare system or in the legal system. So universal screening is really considered a best practice.
I would just really underscore how important it is to actually screen everyone, because even if someone themselves doesn't have an active substance use disorder, part of the inherent beauty of the four P's is that it goes from the margins, right? Questions that are not so much about you in the here and now, to then asking directly about what about you now and your relationship with substances. And if any of those P's is positive, it's giving you really valid and useful information about your patient, right? Maybe she's coming from a home with substance use disorder, and that's a useful thing to know, right? That's telling you that that's an ace right there. Or maybe her partner is using, that's a nice thing to know too. So kind of no matter where you end up, I think you're garnering really useful social history. And that in and of itself is, again, building relationship, but two, also giving you a sense of the ways in which your patient is potentially vulnerable to substance use disorders, or perhaps mood disorders in present and, of course, throughout the postpartum period too. So anyone who's showing up at any point throughout pregnancy and then has a positive on the four P's or in some other way discloses a substance use disorder is able to then connect to Hannah Lippe. Hannah will also take care of postpartum people. We do have individuals, because of a history of having received stigmatized care, do not seek prenatal care until they come in and deliver. And then after that, perhaps they're interested in stabilizing their substance use disorder and getting into treatment. Hannah is very much available for that kind of postpartum case management. I think we all know that the postpartum period actually lasts for at least a year, and really the fourth trimester has become an increasingly popular concept, that the 3 months after delivery are just as important for the postpartum period and bonding and the establishment of breastfeeding for women who choose to do that. And Hannah is available throughout time as well. Hannah does exercise some discretion around her caseload. So if there are times when she's able to take someone who might be 6 or 7 months postpartum, she's able to do that. But the focus is certainly on people who are actively pregnant or postpartum in that first initial 6 week window.
Great. Thank you.
I just had another thought to add regarding screening, and that's on how screening itself could be a way to reduce stigma. I remember reading about, for example, when it came to screening for HIV, how initially that was seen, you know, people took offense because it was such a stigmatized disease, right? Like, people were resistant. Why are you screening me for this? Or what? Or, you know, I think anytime change is brought about, there's resistance to that change, but also because there's a stigma attached to it. And by screening for substance use, you know, even though initially it might feel like, why am I being asked these questions? It's a part of normalizing that process, right? So I always like to think of it as though, you know, nowadays no one sort of blinks an eye when, you know, being screened for HIV is just a routine part of care, and there's no real, you know, stigma behind it. No one thinks twice. It's just part of what needs to happen. And hopefully, screening for substance use eventually gets to that same place. I would like to ask Carrie to touch on this because I think it's so important, is the topic of harm reduction. And I know it's a big topic, but sort of honing in specifically on the pregnant population, how might harm reduction apply to people who are pregnant?
So the harm reduction model, instead of focusing on abstinence only, or instead of focusing on complete compliance with a substance use disorder treatment program, focuses on the fact, and really centers on the fact, that relapse is part of recovery. Just like for a diabetic, Thanksgiving might be a relapse for them in some way, shape, or form. And then they get back on their wagon. And so instead of applying, again, what is actually a very stigmatizing idea of perfectionism and all or none accordance with treatment, harm reduction aims to promote the idea that we want you to be as stable in recovery as possible. We want to give you access to medication if those are applicable for you and the kind of substance that you're dependent on or using disorderly. And we want this accessibility to stay available no matter what. And I think that it's that no matter what accessibility that is really the same lens as a trauma-informed care model. It's saying, we got you. And we are here because we do know that continued engagement in care is going to lead to better outcomes for mothers and their babies and families.
How do you deal with your personal self-care to prevent burnout, and how are you instructing the people that you work with to do the same?
That is such a good question, and I'm going to try to not have a really, really long answer. So I think that first there's things that I like to think of as just pillars of self-care, right? So every single person who's a healer or in a healing profession and a service profession, every day, something from the physical domain of self-care, the emotional domain, the connection, whether that's connection with yourself, a higher self, with other people, and then mental domain, all of that work. And so for me, I meditate and have for years and years and years. I journal and I move my body in some way pretty much every day. And that's just baseline. So right, there's first you have to treat your animal self for burnout and make sure that you're doing these both preventive and things that at times need to be acute treatments when burnout has really, the dial has been turned up to a point of intolerance. And then I really do think that the work of service offers us great opportunities for self-reflection and growth. And I think that as we do this work, we're going to get triggered. We're going to get overwhelmed. We're going to get angry. And I think we're invited to learn more about ourselves through that process. And we're invited to learn how to transform those feelings and those experiences. And I think that the ways that we can work with ourselves are myriad. I know that for me, I practice Tonglen often, which is a Tibetan Buddhist practice where you transform the suffering in front of you by breathing it into your heart, and then you exhale out peace and loving kindness. That's a practice I've used since my early 20s as a medical student. And that can be really powerful to use in real time with people. I also think that rest is incredibly important. Like, we need to take time away. And by rest, I mean, like, actively be bored. Don't watch a screen. Don't do other things. Don't multitask more. I mean, do nothing, because we don't have enough of that, nor do we have a culture that supports that kind of restfulness. And I also think that I couldn't do this work in particular if I did not have a handful of friends and colleagues whom I can call and share these stories with. There is so much power in narrative. And while I am witnessing the suffering of this patient, I need somebody to witness my suffering of sitting with the suffering. And I am so blessed to have a ton of people that I've trained with, particularly from New Mexico and our time working with really just women who have substance use disorders in pregnancy. And we are an incredible support for one another. And I think those sort of major domains of, like, have a practice in place to prevent burnout and treat it when it gets really bad, do some kind of self-reflective work. Those are the things that work well for me. And then have your people and tell these stories. Like, we cannot live with them. Sometimes the suffering is so much for anybody who's even just a little bit empathic, which I think anybody who's been drawn to medicine on some level is, even if they've squelched it as much as they possibly could in order to survive, we have to be heard too.
That's beautiful. I really appreciate you sharing that. And when you do hear other people's stories, it is like secondary trauma in a way.
Yeah.
It's hard to even imagine, like, that person has endured that. It's hard to even imagine what people are capable of enduring. It's really mind-blowing at times. And so you're right, having those practice for yourself and having a team to share. So thank you for sharing that.
I'd like to thank Patty Torres for all her work for the IPA and the RISE Project, in addition to Dr. Carrie Griffin and Dr. Candy Stockton for their hard work and enthusiasm and compassion and passion for improving our present and future community. At the end of the episode, Carrie had referenced a bunch of ideas for taking care of herself and preventing burnout. And we don't have to be healthcare providers to understand that concept of burning out. I think all of us can feel that happening right now. It shows up in little ways: forgetfulness, irritability, you know, just not feeling well, being really tired. And so those are signs of overwhelm. And so taking care, ways to take care of ourselves. Carrie mentioned these pillars of self-care. Everyone, every day, physical, emotional, connection, and mental. And so things with physical is moving the body. That's one of the best ways, in my opinion, to manage stress is just get out for a walk or moving your body in some way, dancing. You know, if there's limitations, moving in your chair, stretching, those types of things. The emotional component, that takes on lots of forms. It could be journaling. It could be talking with a therapist. It could be talking with a close friend. Connection, that's, I love the way that she phrased that, as far as that's connection with others. That could be connection with ourselves. That's connection with friends and family, connection to nature. And then the mental component is similar to the emotional, whatever that looks like. Therapy, talking with others, journaling, meditation, those are all wonderful things to choose from. Getting good sleep, getting good rest, finding things that create joy for you. And I'd like to just leave you with self-compassion meditation, and I'm just going to talk it through, and we'll have a link for the meditation on the Humble IPA website where you find the Humble Healthcast. And so recognizing that in moments of overwhelm and feeling just, gosh, like the world is crashing in on us, is that recognizing that this is a moment of suffering and finding your own words for that. Saying something like, this is really hard right now, or I am really struggling. The next part is recognizing that suffering is a part of life. It's part of being human. And saying something like, many people are going through tough times. And that's not to diminish our own experiences. It's just to recognize that suffering is universal. And it can offer some comfort knowing that. And then the last part is finding some more of your own words to say something like, may I be kind to myself in this moment? Or something that you would say to a best friend, like, I'm here for you. I care about you. It's going to be okay. So hopefully that can offer you some peace, a moment of peace. And our next episode is going to be all in Spanish, which is very exciting. Patty Torres is going to take the lead on that. And then episode 9, following the episode all in Spanish, is going to be stress management techniques. So thank you, as always, for joining us. And find your own ways of being part of the good. The Priority Care Center is located on Harrison Ave in Eureka. And we provide primary care, mental health counseling, care coordination, wellness coaching to people with the following insurance types: Anthem PPO, Blue Shield HMO, Anthem Blue Cross HMO, and Blue Lake Rancheria. Thank you for listening to Humble Healthcast, brought to you ad-free by the Humble Independent Practice Association. Our host is me, Juliet Ferry. Our editor is Joseph Burkett. Original music created by Justin Locke. Our producers are Irina Estes, Jessica Osborne Staffness, Mary Nickel, Patty Torres, and Vanessa Verdiak. Special thanks to Rosemary Denouten for making this project possible. Please share, subscribe, rate, and comment. We are always looking to improve and welcome your feedback. Be part of the good, Humboldt.